Thank you so much for joining us. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and as always, I'm wishing you the best. And today, we're going to have an interesting guest on a little later in the program. That will be Dr. Julie Chen. She is a medical doctor, and we're going to be talking about aspirin, because you've probably been hearing all kinds of things in the news about recent studies showing that aspirin can help prevent various diseases, and yet there is always the potential for increased bleeding, and thousands of people die from overuse of nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, including aspirin, every year. So we'll be talking about the latest research. Perhaps you're wondering what you should do personally. And we'll be looking at some of those issues today, a little bit later on, the natural nurse and Dr. Z. And one thing that's so great about Progressive Radio Network, which hosts this show, is the fact that you can listen anytime from anywhere. So we love you to join us 3 to 4 p.m. every Monday when either myself or my co-host, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, hosts the show live with various guests. And another thing we're going to do today is open up the phone line for questions. So if you'd like to call in, you can give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. And we'll try to get you on the air with your questions right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. In addition, if you don't catch the show live, you can always find us at prn.fm, that's PRN, like Nancy, .fm, and look under archives, look for Natural Nurse, and listen to the show anytime, day or night, and you can download it as well. Not only The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, but you can actually get many excellent shows, including Gary Null's shows, right here at prn.fm. So we're very happy. I know that everyone at the station is working hard to bring you the best information, cutting-edge information for the progressive mind. And it's pretty important to stay in touch. One of the things that I like to work on a lot is survival, because I was very interested in survival way back in the 60s. And in fact, I wound up leaving so-called civilization so that I could live with indigenous healers in various areas around the world. And I wound up spending several years in southern Mexico living with people who might be termed curanderas, that means shamanistic healers. And they used both spiritual intention and herbal medicines. And that's where I began my studies into those fields. And then we've been actually focusing on that all these years since then. And it's interesting to me to see the evolution and revolution, the evolution and revolution that we see as we're moving forward, because more and more people are very interested now in surviving off the land. And a barometer that shows that's true is the favorable ratings for certain TV shows, such as The Doomsday Preppers. Well, that's not a very uplifting name, but they are getting some uplifting records in terms of people who are watching it, I'll tell you that. So that indicates that there is a growing and large interest in being able to survive. And one of the ways that I've always addressed it is really rather than coming from a place of fear, like there might be an electromagnetic surge, which is certainly true. There might be a nuclear war. It's almost, unfortunately, more likely that there will be than won't be, because if we look at the record, humans have never once created various killing devices that they haven't used. So, unfortunately, that's just the way we seem to be. I don't know if we have a genetic problem bent on self-destruction. I'm really not sure the why. Why the powers that be, if we look at companies like Monsanto, if we look at the giant banks that run our culture and are creating devastating consequences on the landscape and in the ecology, which is really destroying the sources of life, which are food and water. So, as you know, there's so many things you can worry about. I always like to really focus on the solution. So, when I decided to leave civilization way back in the 60s and live with indigenous cultures around the world to study how they lived, really what we were calling then off the grid, and I imagine that word still could be useful today, living off the grid. One of the things, which is one of the best possible survival skills that you can have right now, is learn to use the food that is around you. And when I mean by food around you, I don't mean what's in the grocery store. I mean the wild and medicinal edible plants that are growing outside your door. And if you say, well, I live in the middle of the city, nothing's growing outside my door, I beg to differ with you, because even in an urban landscape, we can find edible and medicinal wild plants. So this weekend, and pretty much every week, I give classes in exactly that. And you can go to our website at www.naturalnurse, that's all one word, naturalnurse.com, and you can look under schedule and see the many classes in how to use herbs for yourself and your family, and those are the outside wild edible and medicinal plants that grow in many areas of the United States. I'll be traveling to California next week, Colorado after that, Florida, Massachusetts, Vermont, and in the New York area all summer, including the New York Botanical Gardens. Dr. Zamperone and I are going to the New York Botanical Gardens on May 27th. We will be teaching a lot about the edible and medicinal plants that grow wild right in the places on the edge, sort of, where they don't take care of the plants. That's where you're getting the edible and medicinal wild plants. In addition, at the New York Botanical Gardens, we'll be studying a lot of the tropical edible and medicinal plants. And what's so nice about that is there they are right in New York, and of course they're in the conservatory in the buildings there, because tropical plants don't grow in our area. But many people come with us on our trips to indigenous cultures, including in Costa Rica and in Jamaica. This coming year, 2013, what's very exciting is our trip to Jamaica is being sponsored as a course for credit with the Stony Brook University. And Stony Brook University is sponsoring our course. It's called Ancient and Global Medicine. And it's actually going to be an accredited course. Anyone can take it, either for credit or just come along for the fun. So that's a very interesting progression in a course that Dr. Zamperone and I have been teaching for 20 years. Another thing is, if you go to the naturalnurse.com site and look under education, you'll see that we are now teaching an online course in the use of herbs, and that's for yourself and your family. And there's actually over 200 lectures in that series. And you can take one, or you can take all 200. For each five that you take, each five units that you take, you get a certification in herbal medicine. And it starts from the basics. If some of you are wondering where to start, it starts from the basics. We do outside classes, which you can attend, or we do it by video, where we go outside and dig up some of the wild plants. So let's look at some that I know that you know already. I would bet that there is no one listening that can't identify a dandelion. And that is a good place to start, because it does not have any kind of poisonous lookalikes. And dandelions are used all over the world for food and medicine. They are proven scientifically and studied in mainstream medical literature for their diuretic effects, along with how well they support kidney function and liver function. And you can use dandelion root as a coffee substitute. And this is how we do it. We go out and find a dandelion and then take a very long screwdriver and put it next to where the dandelion enters the ground. Put the screwdriver in pretty deeply right next to it and just turn it in a circle. What that will do is loosen the dandelion root. And then we can pop the dandelion out of the ground, get a bunch of them, wash them off, cut them up, and put them in a glass baking dish. And then bake them for about an hour at 250. That's a very low heat. Or until they get dry and crunchy. You can then go ahead and put them in a coffee grinder if you want to. It makes it into a powder. And there you have your coffee substitute. One of the things that is often added in with the ground dandelion is chicory root. And chicory will be growing soon. You can't gather chicory quite yet, but I'll let you know when it is available or come on any of our herb walks. So we can give you these instructions in person if you come to any of our classes. It is written in our book, The Natural Medicine Chest, Natural Medicines to Keep You and Your Family Thriving into the Next Millennium, which you can find right online at naturalnurse.com under books. And we have a full description of how to gather dandelions and how to cook them into food and medicine. Of course, you can always purchase it in a health food store as an herbal extract or in capsules. So there's all kinds of ways that you can use dandelions. But dandelions have also been studied scientifically by researchers worldwide. For instance, in one study, three groups of rats were used, and dandelion extract was given to the first group. Lasix, which is a drug, a prescription diuretic, was used on the second, and a third group was just given distilled water. And those of you who know about science, that would be called the control group. And the amounts of urine excreted and the amount of sodium and potassium were measured and compared. And what the researchers found is that the dandelion extract was the most effective diuretic. It was more effective than Lasix, but the most impressive factor was that the dandelion exhibited no toxic effects, while the drug Lasix caused serious potassium depletion. And that's why when people are put on those diuretics, they are told to take potassium supplements. So when you get potassium depletion, that can lead to heart arrhythmias, circulatory collapse, and kidney and liver toxicity. And also, this Lasix can be transported through breast milk. So isn't that amazing that potassium loss is so much less with dandelion? In addition, dandelion actually is high in potassium in and of itself. So although it might stimulate some potassium loss by using it and having a diuretic effect, it actually supports potassium because it reinstills it into your body naturally. It's just amazing. The more that I study herbs, the more amazed I am. The more that you get involved in taking care of yourself and your family naturally, the healthier you will be and the more in control you will be of your environment, regardless of what the world throws our way. So I feel that's the best thing to do. So what we're going to do is take our first little break right here, and we're going to listen to a natural medicine chest that Dr. Zamperon and I have put together. And when we come back, we'll be joined by our guest, Dr. Julie Chen, MD. Stay tuned. Be right back with more right here.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss Sar sarsaparilla or Smilax officinalis.
Sar sarsaparilla is a tropical plant which grows in South America, Mexico, and Guatemala. Although most Americans are familiar with it as a flavor enhancer for root beer, it has also been used for its beneficial properties for hundreds of years by many different cultures. In Roman times, the young shoots were eaten, and the mature vines were worn as garlands at festivals of Bacchus. According to ancient Roman writings, Sar sarsaparilla originated when the beautiful maiden, Smilax, was turned into a shrub after her love was slighted by the young crocus.
Sar sarsaparilla was brought to Europe in the 16th century by Spanish traders. A French physician, Nicolas Monardus, published a comprehensive account of Sar sarsaparilla as a treatment for syphilis in 1574. During Portuguese military operations in 1812, a British inspector general of hospitals noted its positive effect on syphilis patients. It has also been used in China for treatment of the same condition. Sar sarsaparilla was included in the United States Pharmacopoeia until 1950 as a recommended treatment of secondary syphilis.
Sar sarsaparilla's medicinal action appears to be a result of binding bacterial endotoxins in the gut, thereby decreasing their absorption. This greatly reduces the stress on the liver and is likely responsible for its historic use as a tonic and blood purifier.
In a controlled study of 92 patients published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1942, a chemically active component of Sar sarsaparilla called Sar saponin greatly improved psoriasis in 62% of the patients and resulted in complete clearance in 18%. Sar sarsaparilla is often recommended by naturopathic physicians for gout, arthritis, and psoriasis. Another folkloric use for Sar sarsaparilla is as a tonic for male sexual potency.
So, if you want a root beard flavored tea with a long history as a healthy tonic, reach for the Sar sarsaparilla in your natural medicine chest.
Welcome back once more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z at Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. And right now we'd like to bring on board our guest, Dr. Julie Chen. Dr. Chen is a medical doctor and integrative medicine physician who is board certified in internal medicine and is also fellowship trained and board certified. She has her own practice in San Jose, California, is the medical director of Corporation Wellness at several Silicon Valley-based corporations, and is on a medical expert on many panels and also nonprofit organizations. She's a recurring monthly columnist for several national magazines and is regularly featured on radio, TV, newspaper, and medicine interviews. And one of the topics that Dr. Chen has been speaking about recently, in fact, there is an article that she wrote on the Huffington Post, is about aspirin, because that's becoming increasingly interesting in terms of the studies that are coming out. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Chen.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're there, right, nice and clear. And also you have another wonderful website called MakingHealthyEasy.com, where people can find out more.
That's right.
Now, let's talk about aspirin, because one thing that's interesting is that aspirin is not a new medicine. It's actually a very old medicine with a long history of use.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. I mean, we've had people taking aspirin for a very long time. First, I would say most of your listeners probably remember that at one point or another, even with grandparents or great-grandparents, you know, talking about somebody taking aspirin and what it's been for. And predominantly, you know, we know aspirin as something that you would take for heart disease prevention or stroke prevention.
Well, I would say in what I remember as a child, and that's many decades ago, is that aspirin was used really in a larger sense to sort of anything that ailed you, for instance, for headaches and backaches and for colds and flus. I mean, aspirin was just used more or less ubiquitously.
I think back in the day, I mean, when people initially were using it a long time ago, I think you know, there was definitely usage for cardiovascular issues, but I know traditionally a lot of people use them for infections, for almost an astringent effect per se. They think it would kill the bacteria and things like that. So I know there's a lot of usage back before we, you know, looked at more in detail what aspirin is really for. And so, you know, when we didn't know as much, because the aspirin potentially helped a lot with the inflammatory issues and fevers of infection, people thought that it really was helping with the infection itself.
That's true. Now, that's very interesting. A couple of words I'd like to focus on in our discussion here. One is the word traditional use, because as my longtime listeners know, the use of the word traditional, to me, needs to be honored. So it just so happens that herbal medicine and acupuncture, which, of course, you are so well trained in, these are truly traditional healing techniques. While very often pharmaceutical drugs are not used long enough to earn the title of traditional. However, in the case of aspirin, I would say it has been used so long that it can actually reflect a traditional use.
Yes, there is a per se, I agree with you, Ellen, there is a per se tradition of usage, because it's something that's been so ubiquitously used by so many people for so many years. So it's per se had a line of lineage or a history to it as well.
More so than many of the pharmaceutical drugs that have come on the market more recently, which very often never get to be honored with the term traditional because they're replaced after maybe 5 or 10 years. They don't seem to have such a long-term life.
Well, I think what ends up happening is that a lot of the hype that initially starts out with medications when it's not yet been able to be made into a generic yet is that there's so much money to be made in the trade name ones. And so you get all this hype and all the commercials, and then after it becomes a generic medication, there's less hype because now, you know, they're not making so much money out of it. And so a lot of the medications that have been around for quite a while per se have that kind of lineage and tradition to it, but we don't necessarily know it as that name anymore, and it's being used in a more generic name type. And so there are other medications, for example, that have had maybe a little longer use, but there's not so much hype around it. And so what the medications that we all tend to know more at the tip of our tongues, per se, are the ones that are getting a lot of hype, a lot of commercials, et cetera. And this is because those first 5 to 10 years, you know, you get the first 5 years, you really get a lot of hype out of it because the pharmaceutical companies are able to make so much money out of it as a trade name. So that's where you get all that kind of inundation of commercialized effect of the medications.
Well, that's a good analysis. So let's really go into some of the new studies. I mean, there seems to be a bunch of them. You talk about one in a discussion that started even this year in January with studies suggesting that aspirin for heart disease or cancer prevention unnecessarily puts these people at higher risk for bleeding. Yet simultaneously, there's all these commercials on TV now sort of saying everyone should take an aspirin, almost as like a vitamin pill.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I think the studies came out, and my article and my decision to write about this per se is really because I have patients who ask about it, and they're saying, well, you know, and I have patients who, when I go through their initial evaluation, will talk about, you know, what medications they're on, and they'll say baby aspirin, and I'll say, well, is that because you've had cardiac issues? They'll say, no, I just thought it would be good to be on it. And so my part of the reason for the article is to really caution people that it is, however benign you think it is, it is still, however, a medication. Just like the way I look at supplements, it's still a therapeutic modality. You really can't say, I'm just going to randomly put myself on a bunch of supplements, because supplements can, in fact, have side effects and harmful causes to our overall health if it's not being used responsibly and with some guidance. And so I usually say to do a little education with my patients about when and why or how they should be taking their aspirin. And so when the studies came out, I think the main reason is because everybody is randomly just taking it, thinking it's relatively safe. And the concern they had is that, you know, are we potentially putting ourselves at risk for increased bleeding, brain bleeds, you know, bleeding from the gut, you know, from our ulcers, or, you know, things that potentially you may not be bleeding from, and that your body could succumb on its own, but with the added baby aspirin, could you potentially be bleeding more unnecessarily on the off chance that you think baby aspirin is going to put, you know, prevent heart disease or strokes for you. And that's where I think, you know, we got that article and that publication, a study out, is because there's that concern.
Well, let's go into, you know, some other aspects of it. What's your feeling on it? What are you telling your patients? I know that you talk a lot about, since, of course, you're more holistically oriented than many mm-hmm. conventional physicians, mm-hmm. you talk a lot about individualization, like what's right for one person may not be the best thing for another person.
Right, exactly. And that's what people, I think, should really look at medication supplements even on a whole. You know, like, for example, you know, a lot of people who are really into mind-body therapies and they want to do hypnotherapy and guided imagery, and even with hypnotherapy and guided imagery, there are populations of people that you want to be careful on how you go about doing that with, you know, especially people with potential psychiatric issues, whether it be bipolar, multiple personality, schizophrenia type people. You know, you really can't, a lot of these things that we think are so benign because it's holistic or that it's natural, that anybody should be fine for. And the way I really want to start to have my patients and overall public start to look at holistic medicine is that it is medicine in some form, and it's any medicine that is healing associated isn't cookie cutter, you know, because everybody is different. And so you really want to make sure that you're getting the custom fit tailored plan that you should have. And so when it comes to things like aspirin, you know, you really want to look at the person that we're dealing with and what are their other medications that are on, they're on, that they need to be on, what are their other medical issues, and evaluate whether aspirin is indeed the right choice for them to be on, even though it's only 81 milligrams, you know, as a baby aspirin. So, you know, people who are older, who have trouble, you know, with walking, if they have no cardiovascular disease, and their family history is very clear, you know, that they don't have that in their lineage, and but they're at high risk for falls, and, you know, they eat a really healthy diet, their sugar control, cholesterol control is beautiful, even without medications, I don't really know that a baby aspirin is great for these patients, because as you get older, the fragility of the blood vessels of the brain and things like that are much, you know, more compromised. So, you know, is that baby aspirin going to help with stroke prevention? Sure. But is this person going to be more likely to have a stroke, or are they going to fall and, you know, have a brain hemorrhage because they're falling all the time? You know, I would say the latter probably is a higher risk for this person, in which case I don't know that a baby aspirin is a phenomenal idea for this patient. So it's, you know, kind of the checks and balances and evaluation that needs to get done like that needs to be done for, I would say, all patients.
So it sounds like you as a physician are not at all sure that everybody should take an aspirin as a reasonable preventive, when always looking at what we want to have in terms of risk-benefit ratio for the individual.
Right, because, you know, we are all taught in medical school to do no harm first. And the reason that that is an important philosophy to hold on to in medicine is because everything that people are taking or prescribing and using potentially can have a positive or negative impact on their health. And so when you're giving one medication, it may be helping problem A, but if problem, you know, B and C are going to be worse from it, and the person has problem B and C, well, is improving the ratio of health on one problem, but then making the other two problems worse, really the better choice? It probably isn't. And that's the way people should really be looking at their checks and balances. I have a lot of patients who come in and they're taking all these natural herbs and supplements, and they'll be on white willow bark, you know, and they'll be on very high dosages of fish oil, ginger, etc. And all of these things tend to thin the blood a bit. And then now they're taking, you know, baby aspirin on top of it, and they have no family history or personal history of heart disease or strokes. They're healthy, their cholesterol and sugars are doing well, you know, and they have no family history of cancers per se. And then the really big question here is, do we really need that additional baby aspirin when the risk of cancers and heart disease and strokes are so low in that person, but yet, you know, they're already on, you know, five other supplements that thin their blood? Do you know what I mean? So it's really about really looking at person to person whether something is appropriate.
Right. But in general, not every doctor is going to, a lot of them just basically don't do all that balancing that you do in your discussion.
Right.
So people might have to look into this a little bit on their own. And I know in the news over the last few weeks, I don't know if you have any of those studies that you could discuss in more detail, because some of them are saying that it's actually very protective against several diseases, not
aspirin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the thing is, you really want to look at your family history, because I don't want the listeners to get the wrong idea that I'm against aspirin. That's not at all what I am saying. I am a big fan of aspirin, especially baby aspirin, in the sense that a lot of patients, that's a safer route to go compared to some of the other medications that they could be on if this is all that they need. And if you have a family history, I have a lot of patients with a lot of long history of cancers in the family, specifically including a lot of gastrointestinal cancers, etc. You know, aspirin is phenomenal for that based on the studies. But my point is that, you know, when you look at somebody, this is not like baby aspirin should be in the water, per se.
Right, which that's another whole discussion, because unfortunately so many pharmaceuticals are winding up just in the regular water system now. That's a major health concern, so it's funny that
that's true.
That
I guess
that.
We are all medicating ourselves for drinking water out of the faucet, yeah.
Now, one thing I'm looking at in your article, it is so excellent for me that you actually do have the references, because that's what I personally like to look at. Mm-hmm. So you have a few very interesting articles right at the end of your Huffington Post article looking at short-term effects of daily aspirin on cancer incidence, mortality, and non-vascular death.
Right.
And what I'm finding interesting is that several of these are all by the same researcher,
mm-hmm.
which is Rothwell.
Mm-hmm.
So I always like to look, and I don't know, you know, what is their connection? You know what I mean? When we look at, like, who's paying for these studies, mm-hmm. we sometimes get some very, very interesting information that way.
Yeah,
I have not done that.
Yeah, I don't know where Rothwell's getting funding from, but what's interesting about the outcomes of these studies, the reason I didn't necessarily look far beyond the ones that are, because his articles are the most recent, and so you want to see kind of up-to-date stuff, what's going on. And what's interesting is there are other, like my fourth reference on there is by, you know, another author, where they look at the meta-analysis of randomized control trials. So it's not just Rothwell's. But my point from picking from those studies is because that is very consistent with what we know in the medical community as far as aspirin is concerned. And I've done a lot of research myself. I worked at the National Health, Institute of Health for quite a bit in different areas of research. And what ends up happening is you start to get to a point where there are certain researchers that do a lot of a specific study type, and because of the way that the funds are put in, and you know, you kind of roll one study off of another, and if you've already had phenomenal studies done on one topic area, it usually makes sense for these investigators to then move on and do further studies of that type. And so that's why you usually will end up, because Rothwell is definitely not the only person who's had, you know, multiple studies on a certain topic. Usually when you start to look at some of the big studies, you start to see that it's the same names that come up over and over. It's because those people have had good success in one topic area, and then they'll roll the funds into doing more to further advance the knowledge of that study. And usually when you do a study, you get to a point where there are still unanswered questions, and then your next study would be to answer those initial, you know, questions that ended up from the initial study. And so that's usually how they work. But I think if you were to look at, you know, medications in general, you know, the ones that you want to be more leery about are the ones that are still in the trade name years, you know, very early on when you're able to keep the patent alive, and so you get a lot more money out of the medications. You do want to actually see where those studies are coming from. But for something like aspirin, where it's generic, it's kind of over-the-counter, there's not a lot of money to be made, et cetera, I'm not as leery, per se, but to be fair, I didn't look into the specifics of this particular author, but the reason I don't is because, you know, aspirin is something where it's not like one pharmaceutical company is making, you know, billions off of it, and so therefore they're pushed to want to put out all these articles on that one, you know, medication because it's still within the patent years for them to make a lot of money. Being that aspirin is, you know, so generic at this point, it's a lot less about money. It's more about looking at the specifics of whether we should use or not. And what's great about, you know, research is that it's good and bad is that, you know, people tend to know their area very, very well, and so the studies that they do tend to be more consistent with it. But then, unfortunately, you do get the same names that tend to show up. And so, you know, that's usually what ends up happening when I look into primary articles for specific topics. But I'm much more leery when it comes to medications or topics where one or two companies are making billions off of it. Then you really want to see where those study results are coming from.
Yeah, and that's very good information. It's too bad we have to be concerned at all about that, but with the long list of, for instance, the falsification of data, I'm not saying that happened in these studies, but that I was reading about recently in terms of the Vioxx studies.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. I mean, this drug that turned out to be very high in terms of its risk assessment, you know, perhaps would not have gotten on the market if there wasn't some kind of fudging of data.
Right.
And the end result was that many people are harmed. So unfortunately, you know, that is something great to keep in mind, and I'm sure you have done that. On the other hand, the breadth of different benefits of aspirin therapy is pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about decreasing possibility of decreasing cancer, decreasing the risk of metastasis from cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just amazing. And I'm wondering what mechanism of action you think that might be linked to. I would think it's anti-inflammatory effect.
Yes, I think so. I definitely think that's a huge effect. And you know what's interesting is because, you know, there's things like, you know, white willow bark and things like that that have been, again, we're going back to that traditional usage terminology. You know, those kind of herbs have been used for centuries for people for inflammation and other disease states. And I think the ability to transcend one disease category into multiple is that ability to potentially suppress or lessen inflammation. And I always tell my patients, you know, what is cancer? What is heart disease? What is Alzheimer's? And we're finding more and more from research because we're understanding more and more the impact of the negative impact of chronic inflammation on health. You know, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, you know, MS, autoimmune diseases, multiple sclerosis, sorry, MS, and, you know, heart disease, cancers. All of this have a huge component of chronic inflammation. That's something that we really want to try to decrease over long term. And so that's why even within the herb category of herbs and supplements that we use for anti-inflammation, there is a, you know, potential side effect of blood thinning. And so, you know, that's why I always want to be careful when we're reviewing supplemental lists and medication lists that you're not using too many for someone who has a potential for falls and risk of bleeding and things like that. But, you know, like you had said earlier, not all physicians are looking through your and nitpicking through your medication and supplement list and your past medical history. So, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the onerous part of the patient having to look at up and keep on top of it themselves is in their own hands.
Now, also downplaying the risk of aspirin, I think, is something that can also be dangerous because it actually is pretty significant in terms of at times doubling the risk of internal bleeding.
Yes.
I don't know if that's in the general population or in some people or, you know, I'd have to read those studies more carefully, but that's not just a little bit. That's
right.
A pretty big effect.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting is nowadays a lot of people take a lot of those proton pump inhibitors, the Prilosex and things like that, and there's always question about decreasing the acid in the stomach and what kind of potential risk that is because the acid itself protects the stomach to some degree with the bugs and all the, you know, H. pylori's and things like that that predispose us to increase ulcer risk. And then now we're taking a lot of aspirin and then, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just, that's why I always, always caution my patients to really try to even keep the supplements and the medications down to a minimum of what you really need and to really get a lot of your healthy habits in your lifestyles that aren't going to have side effects, you know, whether it be eating healthy, using mind-body to decrease stress, helping to control a lot of the you know, gastrointestinal symptoms, whether it's reflux or gastritis from stress, et cetera, to a minimum using other forms besides just a magic pill that you like to pop with medications and supplements. And so, you know, a lot of times when I talk to patients about overall health, you really want to focus on a whole systems approach of getting yourself healthy in mind, body, and diet and everything. And so, I worry about the effect of these medications when patients aren't necessarily tackling the issue by the root of the problem. And then you get to a point where now you've got increased bleeding because you're taking medications, you're, you know, decreasing the acid in your stomach, you know, and onwards and onwards. And so it's just so much more important for people to really focus on trying to streamline their lifestyle modifications first. And then that way, when you get to the point where, you know, you're taking your proton pump inhibitor that inhibits the normal acid in your stomach, and then now you potentially are higher risk for ulcers, and then, you know, because now you have an H. pylori infection, and then now you're taking an aspirin, and then now you're having intestinal bleeds. So, you know, things like that are important to keep in mind.
That's so true. Now, what I'd like to do is we're going to just take a few minutes here for a station ID, and when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We're listening to Dr. Julie Chen, who is giving some excellent, excellent advice, and we'll be continuing our discussion with her right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Welcome back once again to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network, and that's at PRN.FM. You can listen to today's show or any other show that we've done here on Progressive Radio Network right on the archives. If you're listening today and you want to listen again or tell your friends, you know, I heard this great show with this very knowledgeable physician, Dr. Julie Chen, and we were discussing aspirin. I know you said you were going to just start taking a baby aspirin every day. Maybe you should listen to this show first to find out if that's what's right for you. And Dr. Chen is an expert in natural medicine. As we went off, I'm sure that you heard her discussing some of the most important changes people can do for their health, which is eating right and lifestyle changes. And you can find out more about Dr. Julie Chen at www.makinghealthyeasy.com. And that's the word making, healthy, and then E-Z, as in zebra. Just like my partner, Dr. Eugene Zamperone. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Julie.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Now, when you have somebody come in to see you in your practice, what would make you decide that, you know what, maybe they are a candidate for aspirin? And the other question I want to go to is, you know, aspirins come in different brands. There are some that have coverings and flavorings and all kinds of extra ingredients and some that are really plain. Are there any that might be less negative in terms of side effects than others? So let's start with that.
Okay, sure. When my patients come in, I usually will obviously in the first visit get a list of their medications and supplements and their family history. I think anybody with a strong family history of heart or heart disease or with strokes or clotting issues, autoimmune patients who tend to be more pro-inflammatory and pro-clotting, those are good patients, potentially put on aspirin. And anybody with a strong family history of cancers, doesn't just have to be gastrointestinal cancers, just cancers in general, would be a good candidate for aspirin, as long as their stomach integrity and their symptoms for gut are pretty stable. And so, you know, with the caveat, again, that they're not on a bunch of supplements already that they need to stay on, or they're on a bunch of medications that they need to stay on, that already thins the blood. So, you know, people who come in who's already on Agrinox, which is a combination for people on strokes, Plavix, and then the for their medications, if they're on Coumadin or any of the new blood thinners, you know. I definitely have the patients make sure that they're on all of the medications that they say they are and that there's not ones that we're missing before we add on something that thins their blood, primarily because it is such a high risk, and especially if the patients are at older ages. When we talk about putting someone on a specific brand, because a lot of people are actually very sensitive to dyes and fillers, and so I usually have them find whatever brand that's on the shelf that is at an affordable range for them that is the cleanest that they can go. Because our main goal clearly is to put them on a regimen that they can sustain long term. And so, you know, finances.
So what do you mean by cleanest?
So meaning that there's not a lot of fillers, coatings, colors, dyes, things like that. So, for example, I'm going to just kind of throw this out there because a lot of patients may not know this, but even within, you know, various prescription medications, there are options for looking for ones that are filler-free or dye-free or a little cleaner. For example, for thyroid medications, the levothyroxine, there are, and it's not like it's different brands. It's literally like the same generic type, but different doses have different colorings. Like some of the higher dosages or lower dosages may have color versus this one dose does not. And so what we'll end up doing is for someone who's sensitive, we'll put them on, we'll do the prescription as their dosage for the one that doesn't have dyes in it, and then use that medication and use that to get the acquired necessary dosage that they need. So, for example, if it's a 50 microgram pill that is the one that is without a dye, and we need to achieve 100, instead of getting the person a 100 microgram tablet, we'll give them the 50 one and they'll just take two. Or if it's 75.
That's very interesting. I want to go over that again, because that's something I would always do, even with supplements, by the way.
Yes.
Because
yeah.
Even with supplements, they vary greatly. You might have the same supplement. Let's talk about one that's a natural anti-inflammatory like turmeric. Mm-hmm. And you may find a brand that when you look at other ingredients has colorings, flavorings, magnesium stearate, which is a hydrogenated fat. It may have FD&C dye number yellow to make the turmeric look more yellow, mm-hmm. versus one when you read the other ingredients that has none. It's mm-hmm. just pure turmeric. So the same thing right. is true with the pharmaceuticals.
Yes. So I think if someone knows that they have a very strong allergic history, or that they react to a lot of things, or they have autoimmune diseases or chronic hives or a lot of food sensitivities, things like that, you can pretty much, I like to kind of err on being more safe than sorry, per se, and just put them on a cleaner dosing or brand that their body's able to handle, and then dose based on that. And that's, you know, something that sometimes will occur as an option for various medications. So, I mean, there are obviously medications that you don't have an option, but, you know, the thyroid one is one that's actually commonly we'll play around with, because even the same type of medication, the same name, but at different dosages, some have coloring and some don't.
Right, and it's wonderful that you're even looking at that. So that's fabulous, and people can ask their physicians for those as well.
Right, right.
And so you would decide for this patient, and perhaps might you, in fact, consider using some herbs that have much less of an adverse profile in terms of this increased bleeding potential? Like
yeah.
something like, you know, cat's claw might be something you can consider that actually helps to support the gastrointestinal tract. Turmeric, which we mentioned earlier. Ginger, depending on somebody's sensitivity. Mm-hmm. And that might be a better choice for them.
Well, here's the thing is I think it depends on how urgently important is this need for this patient to get a therapeutic level.
Excellent.
So if someone who's already had strokes, or their family history means everyone gets a stroke by the time that they're age, you know, 60 and they're, you know, 58 and they haven't had a stroke yet, those people I probably will go with the aspirin version rather than with the supplements. tends to be a little more consistent from tablet to tablet and type to type as to what you'll get. But, you know, for someone, let's say they've got a lot of other health issues that need to get addressed, you know, for example, someone who's got autoimmune disease or has a history of cancers already, we may want to actually do the aspirin with some turmeric and some ginger and some fish oil anyways. You know, so what we decide to do with a patient from one to another really is, again, dependent on that person. And I don't think that people should think, if I take supplements, I don't need baby aspirin. If I take baby aspirin, I don't need supplements. Or that, you know, I can just do one over the other. For some people, yes, you should just do one over the other, not both. And for some people, they actually should do both.
So that's, and again, looking at each person individually. So this really has to be done by somebody who's knowledgeable in terms of regulating dosages. And would you then do any kind of test to look at perhaps, you know, if there's a blood thinning effect? I mean, is there a test that can be done to determine?
Not at this level. Not at this level that would actually be a blood test worth looking at.
Okay.
That isn't going to over or underestimate. What I will look at, though, is I look at whether someone clinically is looking like they're not clotting enough or they're able, they're actually a little bit, blood is a little thinner. I mean, there are some tests that you can look at blood thinning or coagulation levels, but that's usually it's not like you would monitor that with a baby aspirin or with your supplements. But, for example, if someone is on Coumadin or Agranox or Plavix, you know, on the baby aspirin, et cetera, you want to start to look at whether their platelets are getting too suppressed, you know, or if their INR, which is a blood thinning monitoring level, whether that's getting to be affected, and your prothrombin time and all that stuff. So those are all kind of medical terminology for looking at whether you're coagulating enough or not, or too, or you're not, you know, you're bleeding out, you're at a high risk for bleeding, et cetera. But I do want to caution people that even if those levels are normal, if you're frequently bleeding and you can't stop, you're bruising everywhere, you're starting to get pinprick, blue or red points in your skin, underneath your tongue, you know, you're having some dark stool, you're bleeding from the rectum. I mean, all of those things, it doesn't really matter what your numbers look like at that point. The point is that your blood is too thin.
Right, and let's pay attention to the person and their actual symptoms.
And not
That's
just the
very
right.
refreshing idea. Well, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, Dr. Julie Chen. And you know, with closing remarks, what would you like to share with our listeners?
I think, you know, something I've always just said before is make sure that you're getting on a regimen that is appropriate for you. And if you're not quite sure whether you are or not, is to make sure that you find a healthcare practitioner that can really guide you. And looking at that person's credentials and what their training background is to make sure that they're going to be doing it in an evidence-based way enough for your safety is important. And even though you may not think your primary care doctor cares or knows about this stuff, the primary care doctor should always be kept in the loop of new meds, new supplements, etc. The reason is because, God forbid, anything happens and you end up in the hospital, the person who's going to be following you there is your primary care doctor, and that person needs to know everything that's going on with your health.
That's excellent. And what about information about where people can find out more about your work? Would you say the Making Healthy Easy is the best place to go?
Absolutely. That's my website. That's usually updated monthly with all my articles and information, clinic time changes, etc. So that would be www.makinghealthyeasy.com.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you, listeners. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.